You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko shimena toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnā rā. Kia ora, welcome to The Wire. Today is Wednesday the 14th of June. I'm your host for Wednesdays, Shimena, and I'm joined in studio by my producers, Will and Adam. Coming up on the show today, first we hear a report from my producer, Will, about what went down during Attorney General Jeff Sessions' testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee about the investigation into possible Russian interference in last year's US election. We talked to Tracy Martin from New Zealand First about Labour's immigration policy announced on Monday, as well as the euthanasia bill that was pulled out of the ballot last week. AUT's Alan Blackman joins us again this week for Dear Science. Today we look at some breakthrough innovations that change colour in order to signal important information, such as whether or not your drink has been spiked. We also chat to Alan about some recent controversy around the gene editing technology CRISPR. And finally on the show today, my producer Adam has a report summarising the different perspectives around the controversial euthanasia debate. If you want to let us know your thoughts on any of the things we cover today, as always, 5395 is the number to text, or 309 3879 is the number to call.
You're tuned into The Wire.
Following James Comey's testimony last week to the Senate Intelligence Committee about Russian interference in the US election, Attorney General Jeff Sessions was grilled in his live-streamed testimony earlier this morning. But what actually went down this morning? And did Sessions' answers all stack up? My producer Will has the story.
Attorney General of the United States Jeff Sessions has appeared in front of a Senate Select Committee today to provide testimony addressing allegations of knowledge and or participation in Russian ties within the Trump administration and campaign. These allegations are part of the ongoing investigation into Russian tampering in the 2016 US presidential election. In Sessions' initial address, he reiterates his stance that he had no formal ties with Russian officials regarding the 2016 campaign.
Let me state this clearly, colleagues. I have never met with or had any conversation with any Russians or any foreign officials concerning any type of interference with any campaign or election in the United States. Further, I have no knowledge of any such conversations by anyone connected to the Trump campaign.
Sessions, however, has come under fire for his failure to disclose meetings with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak during his confirmation process as Attorney General. The knowledge of these meetings, although not directly implicating Sessions as having discussed that electoral campaign, has given cause for concern, given the timing and close proximity of the meetings, as well as Sessions' failure to disclose and discuss the meetings in any sort of memorable detail. Sessions has repeatedly said he recalls the topics of these meetings as being foreign matters and not those of the presidential election. Senator John McCain questioned Sessions as to the subject matter of these conversations, to which Sessions replied, in quick succession, "I do not recall."
Did you raise concerns about Russia's support for President Bashar Assad and his campaign of indiscriminate violence against his own citizens, including his use of chemical weapons?
I don't recall whether that was discussed or not.
You raised concerns about Russia's interference in our electoral process or its interference in the electoral processes of our allies?
I don't recall that being discussed.
This failure to respond to the questions under oath may be enough to ring alarm bells for those who are investigating these allegations. But as these meetings were not official, were not recorded, and were left undisclosed for months, this line of investigation may simply lead to more unanswered questions. However, Sessions' blatant refusal to answer a succession of questions about conversations and information shared with Trump had Senator Angus King questioning the legality of Sessions' refusal, to which Sessions became confused and defensive.
Maybe I better listen.
Well, you were part of the national security team, so if he would have heard something about Russia and with their capabilities and our concern about what they could do to our election process, was there ever any conversations concerning that whatsoever?
You testified a few minutes ago, I'm not able to invoke executive privilege. That's up to the president. Has the president invoked executive privilege in the case of your testimony here today?
He has not.
Then what is the basis of your refusal to answer these questions?
Senator Kaine, the president has a constitutional...
I understand that, but the president hasn't asserted it.
Well,
you said you don't have the power to assert these power of executive privilege, so what is the legal basis for your refusal to answer these questions?
I am protecting the right of the president.
Sessions claims his executive privilege to not answer questions, although President Trump has not directly granted it. With Sessions claiming that he is simply protecting the chance that Trump claims the privilege in future, this in itself completely negates Sessions' own refusal to discuss hypotheticals earlier in the conversation. Sessions' testimony in whole has critics unsatisfied due to him darting around specific and directed questioning. His testimony did not expand on previously known information, his answers were evasive and brief, and his ability to recall important conversations with the world's elite has many questioning the legitimacy of his claims. The investigation will continue to seek testimony from Trump's administration regarding the 2016 election. The team leading the investigation and the Senate hope to resolve the issue as soon as possible, but much further information about these increasingly complex and controversial allegations must be uncovered before any progress can be made. Will Parsonson, BFM News.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Yes, thank you very much to my producer, Will, for that report about Attorney General Jeff Sessions' testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee this morning. After the break, we'll be back with Tracy Martin from New Zealand First.
Now it's time for Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party.
Kia ora, Tracy. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. First up today, I'd like to talk to you about Labor's immigration policy announced earlier this week, which proposes that New Zealand cuts immigration by between 20 to 30,000 a year. So even though Winston Peters tweeted his support for the policy on social media, are you worried that this plan by Labor to slash immigration numbers will encroach on traditionally New Zealand First territory?
Not particularly. I mean, I think what we've seen is that while New Zealand First has been talking for 25 years that we need to have a population plan which is connected to sensible immigration, and we've been trashed for it, let's not forget that both Labor, National and the Greens have called us racists and xenophobes for years. What we're finally now seeing is that they've seen that we were right. So, but now what they've got is they've got a problem with trust. So New Zealand First has always said it. We've never deviated from it. So do people really trust that Labor has now finally seen the light and has really got the courage, I suppose, to carry through with it?
And so you're saying that New Zealand First is totally behind Labor's proposal, or do you think there are areas in it for improvement?
I think what interested me most, I think, was actually Andrew Little's statements around international students. And I find them very concerning. I'm working on our international student policy now, talking to the sector, talking to universities and polytechs and wānanga and the student bodies. And what he announced the other day is an incredibly blunt tool that does put at risk an industry that is bringing in between $4 and $5 billion a year. And he's just basically said, we're just going to slash the numbers. So to me, some of the announcement that they've made seem to show a lack of understanding about the nuances of, let's say, export education and the areas where there are spaces for improvement without putting that industry at risk.
Yeah, I mean, I read about how there's the argument from the private training college industry that up to 70% of institutes could close if Labor's policy implemented. So are you saying that this side of the immigration policy needs to be more refined?
Well, first of all, the export education is not supposed to be an immigration policy. So that's one of the things that I'm talking to the sector about. I mean, one of the things that we could be looking at is actually going to something similar with the Australians, which is that students have to return to their home country to apply for permanent residency. We need to be looking at what are the work rights that are currently available to students. But if we were to do away with the 20 hours a week work rights that were only gained in 2014, we would not be competitive at all with most of the Western world. Mm-hmm. So you see, there's parts of this that can be improved upon, and it shouldn't be an immigration policy. But what Andrew Little announced the other day is just like a hammer. You know?
Right. So are you saying that when Labor said that low-level education courses provide foreign students with a backdoor immigration route, is that the thing that you're saying is too much of a blanket approach to it?
Well, and actually it's not the level of qualification that we're talking about. It's the fact that they have been able to have a one-year work right, 2 year, which is called a one-year hunt year, so they can work at anything they like while they look for a job and in the sector with which they trained, and then they get 2 years' worth of job opportunity to work in the sector in which they got their education. But all that was implemented without upping the labour force inspectorate, without actually making sure that NZQA was following up on those qualification levels, at the same time as lowering the English language requirements. So you see, it's a combination of things. To just say you're going to stop having those students does not address all the other issues that need to be addressed, but it does put that industry and the income we get from it at risk.
Mm. And so in terms of other issues, another big sort of thing that Labor was talking about, hopefully the intention with reducing immigration numbers, is that it eases infrastructure and that it lets us catch up on infrastructure. Is this something that New Zealand First agrees with?
Well, we've been saying it for years. So obviously we agree with it. I mean, Labor is merely articulating, the Greens are articulating it. All they're doing is articulating New Zealand First policy. What we do have to come back down to, though, and this would be New Zealand First point, Labor started this. Labor started this this mass immigration, and then it was picked up and run with by the National Party. Why would you assume that the people who started it should be the people who that you trust to put an end to it?
Is this not scapegoating immigrants for these problems, though? I mean, you know, issues with the housing crisis and with transport. It goes much further than just immigrants. I mean, those we already have an existing deficit in Auckland's infrastructure without increasing immigration levels. You know, is this scapegoating immigrants?
Well, I think if people start talking about immigrants, then you're right. It starts to personalise it down to the human. This is about immigration policy. And for years, New Zealand First has talked about, and I want to say it again, we've talked about a population plan discussion. So how many people in New Zealand is the right number of people in New Zealand to keep a standard of living that we all believe is appropriate? Now, that's a conversation we need to have. And then your migration policy actually fits into that population plan policy because you incrementally take yourself up to the level of the population that your country wants to accept. So yes, to just say immigrants does actually start to personalise it. This is about a government policy.
So would this apply to returning or remaining Kiwis? Oh, sorry, would this apply to returning Kiwis as well then?
It can't. It can't apply to them. I mean, there's 23,000 of the 72,000 net that actually people are talking about in the last financial year or whatever. There 23,000 of them were New Zealanders returning and Australians who have the right to come here. So you've got 23,000 people of that 72,000 that you can't do anything about. So you have to actually be working around with those other numbers. Those are the things that New Zealand First is looking at.
And so also what I wanted to talk to you about as well is that, so there is kind of this narrative as well that migrants, we need to prioritise Kiwis first over migrants for jobs, that migrants are taking Kiwis jobs. Is that also something that, I don't know, I feel like this is also another narrative that possibly scapegoats immigrants for some of the woes that we're experiencing in New Zealand, but it doesn't quite nail the issue on its head.
Well, I think, again, the fact that we don't have workforce planning in this country, remember the national government removed it 3 years ago, so there is no responsibility for workforce planning anywhere in this country right now in any government department. The fact that we don't have workforce planning, the fact that we do have employers who are bringing in migrant workers so that they can keep the level of pay lower than they might have to. I mean, this is a supply and demand. If we accept supply and demand around health prices and so on and so forth, why are we not accepting supply and demand arguments around human beings? So again, we want to be sure that the conversation is not on the person who has come to New Zealand for a better life, but we want to make the conversation about the rules that are being applied across the whole of workforce planning and the ability of employers to bring in workers for real shortages, not just to keep wages lower.
But, I mean, regardless of that, though, immigrants in Auckland, for example, are essential to the economic growth of the city, and they contribute much more to taxation and economic benefits, according to a population expert. So I feel like if you drastically reduce immigration numbers, even though you're taking the approach of a more sort of general population management tactic, it still might slow down the economy in terrible ways. So is it not just achieving a balance?
Well, everything is about balance, and you're quite right. And stuff is out of balance now. This is why it's become a major issue. But can I ask you this question? At the end of this year, 100,000 year 12s and year 13 students could actually be out on the job market. Now, is that the person that says that bringing in these people from overseas to fill skill shortages and they add taxes and they do this, that and the other thing, are we balancing what they bring and the taxes they pay with the taxes that actually have to go out paid to support Kiwis that can't get jobs or can't get employment? Are we actually putting those two equations together? Because that's the question. You might be making money over here, but what are we spending over here? And the reality is, nobody's doing the workforce planning. Nobody's doing the mapping to say, okay, we've got 100,000 young New Zealanders coming out of the school system in December. Where are they going to go? Where do we need them to go? And how does that affect the skill shortages that we've got going on in several of these industries? So So then we know how we have to use migration.
I mean, I guess it's interesting, though, because in the days since Labor's policy has been announced, there have been employers that have come out and say, hey, look, if these plans go ahead, we'll be losing our workforce. You know, people in our, you know, working in our restaurant's kitchen, for example, they wouldn't be allowed to work here under these new changes. So I don't know if those if we do put these changes into place, will there be the Kiwi numbers to step up and go into these jobs? And it seems like from anecdotal evidence that that's not the case.
And I think we heard the same thing actually when Michael Woodhouse came out and the national government came out and said, we're going to decide that if you don't get paid over $49,000 a year, you're not a skilled worker. Right, so we heard exactly the same things around about 3 weeks ago. And to be frank, those employers, they're right. They're right. These statements are being made without proper workforce planning, without actually the big picture. So they're both really blunt instruments. Now, what New Zealand First is saying is we want to see New Zealanders at the front of the line for employment and for education and for all other things because they're existing New Zealanders. But we also want to see workforce planning so that we can get a big vision of what should our migration levels be. We want to tighten up on whether employers can just decide that they've advertised, but because a person, a New Zealander, won't take the job for that price, they now have to gain from overseas.
So perhaps
you see, it's such a big picture, you know.
So even maybe a workplace sponsoring migrants to come over as a possible?
Well, I think, again, that my real hope is that if New Zealand First gets the opportunity to have some influence after the 2017 election, that our workforce planning that's part of our tertiary policy will be able to be implemented almost immediately. That should give us a 20-year projection of what we need inside our workforce. Mm. Then we can have a true migration conversation because we'll be able to match what our current Kiwis are doing, the skills levels we haven't got, and the migration that we need, because we're always going to need some migration. New Zealand First has always said that.
And so on to David Seymour's euthanasia bill. So party leaders are saying it's going to be a conscience vote for MPs. And so New Zealand First haven't been clear so far on their standing, waiting to discuss as a caucus. So what are the sort of issues that you need to suss out as a caucus before you decide where you're going to vote on this?
Well, first of all, it is a conscience issue. And on a conscience issue, nobody in New Zealand First caucus has to vote on a party line at all. We haven't had an opportunity to obviously discuss the bill itself and the rules and the levers that David's got inside his bill. But my personal feeling is, when I get to that caucus, is that this is just too big an issue for 121 politicians to decide for this country. I honestly do believe in binding referendum. And this is one of those issues that I think the country needs to have a conversation about, not just 121 politicians.
So what I understand, though, is New Zealand First policy is to have a national discussion over at least 2 years, then followed by a binding referendum. So why such a long time?
Well, it's a big issue, and maybe 2 years is too long. I mean, you know, I'm open to discussion about what is the appropriate amount of time, considering in the light of the fact that Marion Street's petition is currently being considered by the Health Select Committee and has had thousands of submissions. So maybe we don't need a two-year period, and I'll have that conversation with my caucus. But I do think that everybody needs to be fully informed. We can't have extremes on both sides of this conversation kidnap the conversation, similar to what we saw with the anti-smacking bill. We want the general public to be as fully informed as possible, and sometimes that takes time, but it may not take 2 years.
And so in terms of your own personal stance on the issue, where do you sit?
Well, I was just having that conversation with my husband last night, actually. And you know what? I don't know. I truly, truly, truly don't know. I've had family members that I have nursed to their death. It's really around the rules around which that might take place. And then I have to be confident that it doesn't open a door for downstream, the changing of those rules so that it becomes a much wider opportunity. So honestly, right now, I do not know. I do not know.
Right. So trying to achieve that balance between giving people the right to decide and it becoming a slippery slope to questionable
things.
Yeah,
that's the one. That's the one. I mean, you know, it's such a big conversation, and I really want to hear, I need to hear from a lot more people. before I can make up my mind.
Cool. Well, thank you for speaking with us this week, Tracy. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.
That was Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party. The Wire.
Yes, it certainly was. And we will be back after a break with Dear Science.
95BFM and NZ On Air Music presents Out on the Freak. Out on the Freak delivers three shows over 3 weeks in three Auckland suburbs. All ages, all free, and broadcast live to BFM's Freak the Sheep. The series kicks off on Wednesday, June 21st with a night of Americana at Devonport's historic Vic Theatre, featuring Bernie Griffin and the Thin Men, Josie Tuck and the Miltones. 95BFM presents Out on the Freak, number one, June 21st at the Vic Theatre Devonport from 7 p.m.
Psychic glands, delicate folk reveries, woozy psychedelia, deeply stoned lunar ragas, and assorted from off the beaten track to keep you busily zoned out well into the evening. Psychic glands, Thursday nights from 11 p.m. with Aaron. It's dreamy, atmospheric, appointment listening.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, we have AUT's Alan Blackman joining us now in the studio. How are you going today?
Oh, yeah, not bad. Lectures are finished, so the kiddies have got their exam in about, an hour and a half.
Oh,
so.
Soon?
Oh, yes.
Have you been receiving lots of frantic last-minute emails?
Not too many, actually, yeah, okay. Which is probably not a good sign.
But they're just maybe just going to wing it.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, we'll see.
So first up today, a group of students have developed a straw that can test for date rape drugs.
Yeah, this is rather interesting. So a bunch of, in fact, high school students over in Miami. So the Miami Herald, I believe, runs a business challenge every year and is looking for sort of entrepreneurial ideas, and one of the winners this year were three high school students in their last year at high school. And as you say, what they did was to develop drinking straws that would change colour in the presence of both GHB and ketamine, which are sort of the two big date rape drugs. And this is really impressive, certainly for high school kids. It really is quite an astonishing feat. The idea has been mooted previously. There's an Israeli company out there that has said that this is what they are doing. They haven't yet gone to market, seemingly. And there's been other ideas as well where they take sort of the whole drinking glass and stuff like that, and even nail polish as well, apparently, which will sort of change colour in the presence of these things. So it's a good idea, but in my view, very, very difficult to implement, and it'll be interesting to see whether this does end up coming to market. It hasn't yet. At the moment, it's just an idea. The kids are seeking patent protection on it, which is a very, very good idea. The one thing that they don't want, as far as I can see, is false positives. Obviously, you don't want false negatives, obviously. But you certainly don't want false positives, because then you are in the very dangerous position of making a very false accusation of, you know, attempted sexual assault or
absolutely.
Rape or something like
and
that.
Absolutely, and then does this become evidence used in a courtroom?
I'm sure it does, but that's why it is so vital that they get it absolutely right. And and speaking as a chemist, I think it's an extraordinarily difficult thing to do, to get this absolutely precise for only these date rape drugs and nothing else that's in your drink. And I guess, as everyone well knows, there's a whole heap of different alcohols out there. There's your beers and your wines, and then there's all of the spirits, and you're going to make sure that in all of those things there's nothing that's going to nothing else that's going to lead to a false positive.
Yeah, so, for sure.
Very, very difficult, but it'll be interesting to see how this one plays out, and as I say, whether it ends up coming to market. But it is a really, really good idea, obviously.
And I'm also interested with the concept as well, is that it made me think of, you know, with performance drugs and about how the, you know, IAAF are sort of always one step behind with innovation on drugs. So then is that, does that then create a situation here where these measures become one step behind people creating these drugs? They find a way to be able to... For the drug, they make a small adjustment to the drug that then it doesn't show up.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's always going to be the case, sadly, always. And you know, this is the case with, you know, your synthetic cannabises and stuff like that. That all of these new things that are coming out are, you know, they're not able to be tested for until somebody comes up with a test, because for the very reason they don't know what they're going to test for.
Yeah.
You know, so. You're absolutely right. So, you know, if there are these new sort of stupefying drugs come out, then you're going to have to make another specific test for these things. So you've got one set of chemists following another, I guess, would be the way that you'd look at it. And it's sad that the world's come to this. It really is. Mm. But that's inevitably the way that it's going to be.
Yeah. I also thought it was interesting, though, in the way that it could act as a possible deterrent to people, that it's such a clear... public display.
Indeed.
Of whether somebody's drink has been spiked.
Yes.
That, yep. You know, that's quite shameful.
Worse than shameful, hopefully. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, oh shit, you
yes.
caught me.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Which again is the reason that you can't have those false positives.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it would just be. Yeah.
For sure.
Not only humiliating, but also probably, you know, it would lead to a lawsuit straight away, of course.
Definitely.
You know, in the States, the home litigiousness.
So. Just love suing each other.
Oh, yes, they do. Yes, yes.
And so our second story today is similar to the first one in a way that it's a new innovation that changes colour to indicate something, except it's a tattoo on someone's skin that changes colour when their blood sugar levels rise. Tell me about this.
Okay, so these are researchers at MIT and Harvard, which, you know, are the top universities in the States. And you say it's an innovation, and you're correct, but again, this is something that hasn't come to market yet, which... kind of makes me a little bit uncomfortable. I don't see why people necessarily do this to sort of announce something that would be an extraordinarily useful breakthrough without it actually having been trialed clinically yet, or certainly it hasn't undergone human trials. So, as you say, what it is a tattoo using special ink, and the ink changes colour as your blood sugar level alters. And any of your listeners who are diabetic will know this only too well, that the current methods of measuring blood sugar is quite invasive and, you know, a real hassle. And I think this is a brilliant idea, that you could just have a tattoo on there, on your skin, and the colour of the tattoo correlates to your blood sugar level, and that then obviates you having to, you know, prick your skin or you know, however else it's done. So I think it's a really, really good idea. They're also looking at being able to monitor your sodium levels as well, and in addition to the blood sugar. So, you know, that's saying whether you've got high sodium or whatever. And I think that's a great idea, and also the pH of your blood as well. And what they've done thus far, they've shown that it works on pig skin, and pig skin apparently is very, very similar to human skin.
Mm-hmm.
And they've shown that it works there, but as I say, they haven't done the human trials yet.
Yeah.
And given that this, is going to involve humans, it's probably a long and involved process, again, over in the States, getting any sort of...
ethical sort of
yes, all of that sort of stuff. Whether it's got to go through FDA, I'm not sure, but, you know, if it does need to do that, then... probably commercialization is a long way down the track. And so you've got, as was seen on the comments section of this, when I picked it up off the web, there's a lot of people out there.
Comment sections, my favorite.
Well, you know, there's a lot of people out there who are saying, you know, pick me, I'm diabetic, I would love this, you know, it's a great idea. So there's a lot of people out there whose hopes are now being raised.
Totally.
If this doesn't work out, then... you know, people's hopes have been raised unnecessarily. I really don't think that's a great idea.
Yeah, right. So, what are you saying, that they should have not publicised the successes with the pigskin trial?
Well, to me, I mean, one of the reasons that you might publicise this before it's finished is that somebody else is working on the same idea. Possibly.
Just to be like, yep, guys, we got there first.
Yes, yeah. So I don't know. I can't really see a great reason for not waiting until this is at least further down the line before coming out and saying that, yep, this is, you know, this is going to be happening. And as I say, you know, there's an awful lot of people out there who'd love for this to be real. And, you know, hopefully they're not disappointed somewhere down the track. But and it's a beautifully simple idea. I'm amazed that actually nobody's thought of this sooner. You know, it's very, you know, everything's obvious in hindsight, I guess, but you know, you know, the whole idea of things changing colour with in the presence of particular compounds, you know, that's all your titrations and stuff, all the people listening have done at high school and stuff like that. That's the whole basis of chemical titrations, where something changes colour at the end of a titration, etc., etc. So it's a very, very, very simple idea, but really nicely applied.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess it's just now the yeah, like you say, the ethical component of testing it with human because humans, because, I mean, what if somebody reacts to the ink, for example?
Yes, indeed.
As a terrible allergic reaction or something like that.
Yep. Well, that's part and parcel of human trials. They, you know, there's more than one drug that's been, you know, shown to be perfectly safe in animal trials, and then they go and put it in humans, and you get horrific side effects. I remember there was one in England a few years ago where people's heads started growing. It was absolutely horrific, and there was a New Zealander involved in that too, from memory. I can't remember what the drug was, but there were just awful, awful side effects.
Oh,
horrible.
Wow.
Absolutely horrible. So,
yeah.
You know, everything can look good up until those human trials, and then all of a sudden, for some, you know, God unknown reason, things don't work the same in humans as they do in animals. So,
How do you bridge that gap, though, you know?
Ideally, in years to come, you should be able to use computers. You know, they should, in probably many, many years to come, you'll be able to use computers to be able to just model, I guess, the human body. We're not there yet. We're not even close to being there yet. But somewhere down the track, I'm sure we will be. So,
well, what do they do now? That do they just have to risk it and hope for the best?
I think that's basically it. Yeah, pretty much. But they've got to do those extensive animal tests first.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And sadly, that's, you know,
sometimes
it kind of has to be. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I guess also the thing is that, I mean, maybe not necessarily for this case, but with things like, I don't know, terminal cancer, that people are like, well, I'm going to put my hand up because what do I have to lose?
Yes. Yes. Indeed. Anyway? Yes. Mm. Yep. No. Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm. Cool. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show again this week, Alan.
Not a problem.
We'll talk to you again next week.
Surely will. Okay.
That was Dear Science.
The 95BFM Breakfast Club is back again this Friday from 7 a.m. Drop into Real Groovy Records, Queen Street, and get amongst the Mikey Havoc Breakfast Show live broadcast. Grab a coffee thanks to Coffee Supreme and enjoy live performances from Jess B from 8:15 and Siobhan Leilani with full band just after 9 a.m. The 95BFM Breakfast Club, live at Real Groovy Records this Friday from 7 a.m. Thanks to NZ On Air Music.
I'd been starting to think that everything was just getting worse. Summer's hotter, winter's colder. Someone let a loaf of bread with a face drawn on it be Prime Minister. And now, all my targeted advertising is for weight loss and cheap therapy. But then, I heard that B Street was coming back. B Street, 95BFM's K-Ro Block Party, is returning soon. Escape the doom and gloom with good times, great music, and 95BFM.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
And finally, on today's show, a new bill has been opened up for debate in Parliament, one which has flared opinions and emotions. If passed, it would see euthanasia legalised here in New Zealand. Producer Adam Jacobson investigates the arguments surrounding the debate.
A divisive question is being asked in Parliament. Will it be legally acceptable to voluntarily end one's own life? The End of Life Choice Bill is postulating this question. Pulled from the members' ballot box last Thursday, it will give people over the age of 18 and in an irreversible physical or mental condition the option to choose medically assisted death. Bills similar to this one have been debated in Parliament twice before, with the first being defeated 61-29 votes in 1995 and again in 2005 by 60-58 votes. But the main difference now is the degree of public support, with a 2017 poll showing 66% of participants were in favour of law reform.
That's right, I'm David Seymour, leader of ACT New Zealand.
Seymour is the initial proponent of the bill, drafting it nearly 2 years ago. I spoke with him regarding the finer details of the bill.
So the end-of-life choice gives legal options to people who are at the end of their life and are suffering. It only applies to people who have either a terminal illness, something like cancer, or what we call irremediable condition with egregious suffering. And that could be something like Huntington's disease. And that's a condition where you're only going to get worse, and people actually want to take control and end their suffering while they can. You have to be examined by two doctors, and the bill sets up a special registry in the Ministry of Health to appoint the second doctor. So the first doctor can be a normal doctor, but then you get a second one picked at random, so there's no stitch-ups between a coterie of doctors who do this stuff. It's randomly selected. And then if you can show that you are of sound mind and that you understand the decisions that you're making and that you're not being pressured or coerced, then you will be given the option of a doctor either giving you the means or applying the means to end your life at a time of your choosing.
Seymour says one of the reasons for drafting the legislation is that he believes it's important for people to have a choice, as some may turn to unthinkable alternatives to end their suffering.
Some people commit violent amateur suicide, and we think that's about 8% of elderly suicides are people with terminal illnesses or egregious medical conditions. The other option is that people can refuse treatment. It's quite legal to refuse treatment, refuse food and water, starve yourself to death. Some people do that, and that is a horrible option as well.
By the selecting of the end-of-life choice bill, it is resurfacing a long ongoing debate between those who are proponents and opponents of euthanasia as a practice, with strong opinions being held on both sides.
Philippa Malpass, and I am a senior lecturer in clinical medical ethics. So I'm a member of the End of Life Choice Society, which used to be called the Voluntary Euthanasia Society of New Zealand.
Malpass is a supporter of euthanasia reform, stating that the benefits of medically assisted death lay in giving people the option as to how they wish to pass on, but affirms that it is solely down to a person's choice whether or not to proceed.
You know, there'll be people for whom some degree of suffering, and I guess I mean by suffering, I don't just mean physical suffering, but other kinds of suffering, existential suffering, you know, spiritual suffering. For them, there might be some real benefits in suffering at the end of life. It might, you know, draw them closer to God or whatever. For a lot of people, though, suffering at the end of life is something that they're very fearful of and maybe have experienced it. And for them, actually, having a choice is really important. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, that's actually what it's about. You know, I think it's about having an informed choice, being able to make an informed choice, and then to have access to that kind of assistance from our medical profession.
Secretary of Care Alliance Matthew Jansen, on the other hand, is a vocal opponent to the bill.
The Care Alliance very strongly opposes the legalisation of euthanasia and assisted suicide.
I question him about why the Care Alliance has such strong opinions towards opposing the end-of-life choice bill.
Because it's unnecessary and dangerous. It's unnecessary because palliative care very well contains pain, physical pain, as well as all of the social and spiritual dimensions of dying. So it's unnecessary. And it's dangerous because it puts at risk some of the most vulnerable people in our society.
Jansen reaffirms that palliative care should take priority, as it takes in a wider scope of the issue.
It puts the patient right at the centre of all of the care. It's not just medical, it's social and spiritual and economic care that is given to people. So they have more choices in palliative care than outside it, and they certainly have more choices than just that simple, brutal choice of death.
Immediate past chair of the New Zealand Medical Association, Dr. Stephen Child, gives a similar opinion upon reform.
We do not support the law change for euthanasia.
Child's primary concern revolves around the determination whether a patient is of sound mind, which is a primary acceptance factor in the end-of-life choice bill.
Now, that's not as black and white as it obviously occurs, in that many people, when they have terminal stages of cancer, are on medications that may affect their mentation, or can have metastasis to the brain that can affect their mentation, or can have a feeling of depression and hopelessness, which is temporary due to pain, that with good palliative care, when that pain resolves, they change their mind. A similar example in my career, for example, is many times I'm making assessments as to whether someone is capable of living on their own independently or whether they need to go into a rest home. And that sometimes is a very, very difficult decision to make, whether they are competent to make the decision. If I get it wrong, though, when I've put them in a rest home, they can always come out of the rest home. That's not the case with voluntary euthanasia.
An additional concern of Child's is the extreme pressure which doctors will be placed under if voluntary euthanasia is to be legalised.
Let's say a 49-year-old man is diagnosed with prostate cancer, and he has, on average, 5 years to live. He gets treated for his prostate cancer, though, and it makes him impotent and it makes him incontinent. That makes him depressed. He loses his job. His marriage breaks up. Then one of his children is killed in a car accident. He gets very depressed and he comes and requests euthanasia. Life is unbearable suffering for him now, and he would like to end it. He repeatedly says that over 2 or 3 months. Should we give him euthanasia? Is that a rational request or is that an irrational request? And you, society, will be asking doctors to make that decision.
The debate surrounding the end-of-life choice bill is one of extreme importance. The fact of dying is a human one and one which everyone will have to face at some point. Allowing for an open dialogue on such a bleak topic is crucial if we are to mature as a society. The end-of-life choice bill will be sent to a conscience vote on the next Members' Day, either immediately or post the election in September. Adam Jacobson, BFM News.
That was The Wire.
Yes, that's the end of another Wednesday show. We had a lot of great content today, discussing a couple of controversial issues there, but I think my producers did a fantastic job with their reports that they did. Thank you, of course, to everybody who spoke with us for the content we played today on the show. Also, yes, a big thanks to Adam and Will for helping out this morning. Up next, 1 to 4, Sam Harmony is covering Bridge, who I believe is still writing his essays in the library, but I think he might be back again with us next week. But yeah, stay tuned. Have a great afternoon.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.